I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to The Connection. It's been a quarter of a century since the September 11th terror attacks, when hijackers took control of four airplanes that took down the World Trade Center towers, destroyed a part of the Pentagon, and crashed into a field outside of Shanksville, Pennsylvania. 2,977 people died that day, with thousands more injured or dying later as a result of the attacks. Most Americans witnessed the events that day glued to the wall-to-wall coverage on television. I'm sure you can recall some of those images, the towers under attack, dust-covered crowds running for safety, first responders sifting through the rubble. Well, today on The Connection, we reflect on September 11th, 25 years later. How have families cope with the loss of their loved ones? What have we learned about trauma and healing? How do we remember that tragic day? And what's the role of rituals and commemoration when dealing with a crisis? Here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Tara Bain. She's an art therapist whose husband, Michael, worked on the 100th floor of the North Tower and died on September 11th. She's written a very moving memoir, Evolution of a Heart, from the darkness of 9/11 to rebuilding a life and finding joy. Tara Bain, it's a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Barbie Zelizer, and she's Raymond Williams Professor Emeritus at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Her work is focused on memory and images in times of crisis. She worked as a journalist many years ago. And Barbie Zelizer, nice to have you with us today on The Connection as well.
Nice to be here.
You know, Tara, I'd like to begin with you. First of all, I just want to thank you. And I did say to you before we went on the air, is there anything that's off limits? And,
yeah.
And that still stands. So thank you again for joining us today on the show. How are you going to mark this 25th anniversary? What are you going to do?
I have a busy day. I'm going to be at the Garden of Reflection in Lower Makefield Township, and I'll be speaking in the morning. They have an 8:30 ceremony, and then in the evening they're doing a 5:30 evening ceremony, and I'll speak there as well.
Does this feel different from, let's say, the 24th, the 23rd, the 20th, the 15th,
yeah.
the 10th?
You know, the anniversaries blend together. They are difficult days, always,
sure.
I think they'll always will be. But this feels a little more tension with it, the prepping and all that's happening around.
Is it possible to describe, I feel a little awkward asking this, especially so early in the interview, but how your grief has changed over these 25 years? I mean, I cannot imagine what
right.
it was like 25 years ago.
Yeah.
But today, how do you live with your grief?
The grief, I always say it's there. It's doesn't go away. I mean, if you love someone, you'll have grief if they're gone. But it doesn't take over my life. And I've been able to balance it with having happiness and joy and people in my life that I love and all those things.
But there's been the sort of public, I'm
yeah.
assuming public face
mm-hmm.
of your life, and then the private face. Has it been hard to reconcile those two?
Sure. When I had remarried, and when I was dating him, when I was walking around town, people would say, "Oh, you're Tara Bain, you lost your husband," and I would just feel like very challenging. So I struggled with a lot of grief about guilt about becoming involved again with someone, and I don't have that now. I'm since then divorced and with someone for 8 years, but Michael's still in my heart.
Right. I mean, it's a process, right?
Yeah,
it's
definitely a process. And certainly what it looked like that first year, I'm nowhere near there.
Indeed. And I do want to get to that. Let me turn to you, Barbie. And I think for many of us, and already I'm sure other people are beginning to see on TV some of those images from September 11th. You know, it's sort of boiled into our brains. How do you see this anniversary?
It's interesting. I see it as a big anniversary because it is 25 years, but I also think that from year to year there are incremental changes in how we remember. And I think that much of what Tara is talking about in terms of how you go through each rendition, as it were. You don't exactly know who else is there with you. And so the media are there to kind of create a collective. And they do that very, very competently.
I mean, we're talking about hundreds of millions of people. How do you create a kind of collective either memory or even image or recollection?
Well, but we have.
We have.
I always liken this to the students in my class who, when I ask who was alive during 9/11, and they all say no, but they all know what it looked like. Mm-hmm. And the reason they know what it looked like is they remember what the media have given them, not only this year, but every year. And so there's a kind of familiarity, a repetitiveness to this that really does serve a purpose in kind of helping us move through the day.
I was reading about flashbulb memories. I mean, and I think this probably applies to some of those images from September 11th. They were so shocking that they just seem like imprinted on our brains.
Barbie? Yes, they are imprinted in our brains, but they're also unstable. You know, what we are willing to look at today is not what we were willing to look at the 10th anniversary, for instance. So there is a kind of repertoire mm-hmm. of images and of stories that we know we're going to hear and see again, right? But at the same, and I think that we hearken to that, right? Because it's not necessarily about learning anything new. It's about being stabilized in how we feel on the day. It's about coming together around things that are already familiar.
I'm wondering for you, Tara, when you see those images as you are and you will,
yeah.
Can you relate to them?
I avoid seeing them.
I bet.
Because, I mean, even just as we talk about them, I don't need to see them. They're in my brain, like you said, they're imprinted. And at the same time, I think that it's really important that they keep showing those images, especially for this next generation coming up. So,
because they're so powerful. And
they're powerful.
They're almost, even 25 years later, Barbara, hard to comprehend.
Yes. Yes. They were hard to comprehend at the moment. And, you know, there were images that kind of disappeared very quickly. But I think that the images that have remained are at the core of how we understand what happened. There are many images of groups of people. So that kind of harkens back to the collective, right? The fact that we all went through this together. And I think that those are the images that kind of, you know, hang on from year to year.
Do you feel like you've gone through this with other people, Tara?
Yeah. In the very beginning, it was my grief, my husband. And as I went downtown and went to various events, it was, oh my gosh, it's everyone's grief. Yeah. So many people who died and so many people feel what I feel. And so it's this kind of back and forth for me.
In your book, you write about your life before you met your husband, Michael. Mm-hmm. You write about falling in love with him, that you sort of clicked right away. Mm-hmm. I circled that in the book because it seemed like you had a kind of instant chemistry. What was he like, your husband?
He was fun to be around. He was quiet, compassionate. He was very athletic. He loved music. I mean, he was such a good guy. You know, just so trustworthy and hardworking.
And you were 30 years old.
I was 29.
29 on September 11th.
Yeah.
So you were young and what, newly married, I guess?
We were married for 4 years. We were just starting to try to have a family. And then he didn't come home.
Yeah. In fact, you describe that day. I almost hesitate to go here, but again, it's in your book, so I feel a permission to go forward where you almost like, it's almost like a movie in a way. You describe what the terrorists were doing, what was happening as each plane took mm-hmm. off from where they did, and then what you were doing, going to work. I mean, the sort of mundanity of mm-hmm. getting in the car and going to work, but right at the time of the attack on the North Tower, you called your husband at the very same moment.
Mm-hmm. It was very bizarre. I just felt moved to call him, and we didn't talk in the morning. He left very early, and I didn't work until about 9. And so I was running late, and I just said, I have to call him.
Yeah.
was fast busy, and then I called a cell phone. We had cell phones, but it was just for emergencies back then. We didn't live with them like we do now. And I tried it, and that was busy.
But it sort of underscores in life is you, I mean, God, this is going to sound really trite, but you just don't know. You don't know Mm-mm. what's going to happen.
And I often say that on the anniversary, like, hug your loved ones a little tighter and appreciate what you have, because it can disappear in an instant.
How do you see sort of collective, I guess, loss and grief, Barbie? I mean, as we mentioned earlier, everyone is going to experience this in their own way, and yet there seem to be some things in common.
Yeah. I would say that there are three things in common. There's collective loss, there's collective grief, and there's collective trauma. And all of them, at some level, kind of disrupt experience. We can't really, they kind of stand in our way of integrating those particular kinds of thoughts back into ourselves. And it's that tension, right? How do we reintegrate loss? How do we move beyond grief? How do we continue to accommodate grief while still being able to articulate it, right? How do we recognize trauma? All of those are kind of like blocks in the road. Right. And that is part of the reason, I would say, that collective memory is so strong, because it's by coming together with others. It's by creating rituals. It's by knowing what the day is going to look like. I mean, I know people who go to the site every year. Yeah, I know sure. people who engage with the media in a very particular way every year. People who look at retrospective volumes every year. So there's a kind of safety that comes with this ability to come together that I think is particularly around grief, loss, and trauma.
It's so interesting,
yeah,
because
go ahead, Tara.
Every year I'm often interviewed, and people say, why do you do that? Why do you do it? And it's to keep not just my husband's memory alive, but it's that collective experience that people still need to hear about it. Yeah. And that's what I feel so strongly about.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense. And I think that it's so powerful because people are attuned to that, to your decision, mm-hmm. right? You know that people are going to want to listen.
Yeah.
And that I think says everything.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Tara Bain and Barbie Zelizer as we mark the 25th anniversary of the September 11th terror attacks. Tara Bain lost her husband that day on September 11th. He was working in the North Tower, working on the 100th floor, I should say. And Barbie Zelizer has been affiliated with the Annenberg School for Communication at Penn for a number of years. And again, her work focuses on memory and images in times of crisis. Much more after this very short break. Just stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and today we are reflecting on September 11th, 25 years later. And again, Tara Bain is our guest. She's an art therapist, and she has written a memoir, Evolution of a Heart, From the Darkness of 9/11 to Rebuilding a Life and Finding Joy. Barbie Zelizer is with us as well. She's the Raymond Williams Professor Emeritus at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. And again, her work focuses on memory and images in times of crisis. I wanted to pick up on something you were talking about, Barbie, before the break about, you know, why if we had so-called nothing to do with September 11th, we didn't know Tara, we didn't know Michael. What are we mourning? I mean, if it wasn't us, what are we mourning? What are we grieving? What is the loss we're experiencing if we have no personal connection to anybody that day?
Well, first of all, individual identity only goes so far. We're also members of groups. We're members of families. We're members of, you know, exercise groups. We're members of occupations. And so with each group that we become a member of, we form memories with them. So when we're talking about September 11th, we're talking about the social formation that we call the society, our country, our nation. And we lost a lot on that day. We lost a lot on that day, symbolic, political, military. I mean, historically, this is the moment that Fortress America, which was the idea that kind of unified the country from the Cold War on, this was the day that Fortress America dissipated, right? It just went away. And this notion that we were safe in our homeland and that terrorism was something that occurred abroad, right, that completely switched over. And so there's no question that though personal loss trumps the picture in so many ways, the collective loss was huge, and it still is huge. And the interesting thing that we know about collective memory is it doesn't happen immediately. It usually takes 2 to 3, sometimes even 4 decades before memory sets in. And that's because that's the life of a generation, right, when you think about it. And so we're really at the beginning right now. Like, we are struggling. I mean, there are differences across the different anniversaries, but 25 years hence, this is the moment that things are going to become stabilized or begin to become stabilized.
Become stabilized. That is a long time to process something, but obviously the enormity of what happened on that day is just so powerful. To you, Tara, what was helpful, especially in those early hours, days, even weeks after September 11th, what was helpful for you?
I wasn't functioning well at all, so I had family around me, making sure that I ate something and, you know, did all those things. I wasn't alone for several weeks, probably, but I remember my sister telling me, because she's the only one in my family that lived in the same town as me, everyone is in New York, that there were other people in my town who lost someone, and that was so strange to me, even though, you know, those buildings came down. And I think it was helpful having those connections with others going through what I was going through.
Right.
And I even, in some ways, it trumped my family support, because I knew with those who went through it, I could be any way I wanted to be. I didn't have to put on a facade of any way. And so that was definitely helpful. And I think overall, you know, as a nation, one of the things that sticks with me is that we became so vulnerable, and we never experienced that. At least my generation never experienced that, and I certainly felt that, and I felt unsafe for quite a while.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, not wanting to fly, I'm sure.
Yeah, I made myself go on a plane.
Did you really?
Yeah, it was December.
Wow. December of that year?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I thought I would die, but I made myself go on.
Yeah. Barbie, I was reading that on September 11th, the majority of Americans were watching television. I think I have that correct. Mm-hmm. So, myself included, and everyone I know included. So, we were all watching this event. 25 years later, the media is so different. I mean, it's sort of hard to imagine what it would be like. But how did that, I guess, cement the experience, the fact that we were all, in a sense, watching together?
I mean, don't forget, we were watching together because there weren't alternatives.
That's right.
I mean, cell phones were mostly used for voice conversation. The internet was just kind of becoming a thing. So it was really television, radio, and the press, the three traditional legacy media that are all now going through difficulties. But so I think that, you know, the kind of collective memory that forms from that is certainly different in quality from what we might get now. Now we might see people on their phones. We might see people on social media. I mean, even if we look at the practices that we're seeing kind of build up for this particular anniversary, I mean, a lot of it has to do with social media. It's, you know, doing personal tributes. And, you know, there's a campaign, I think, from the 9/11 Memorial and Museum that everybody should take a picture of the sky.
Oh,
and they're going to build like an installation from pictures of the sky. You know, so there are ways to move with this from different media. The fact that we had broadcast and a legacy press that was, it was what everybody read, yeah, right, made it far easier.
Tara, you write in the book that for the first year after September 11th, you did watch television, but at some point,
yeah,
you turned it off. Mm-hmm. Was it just, you were done? It was too triggering?
Yeah,
what was
so,
going on?
I mean, in the first week, probably, I had it on 24/7, and then just normal, like, I watched a lot, and I felt unsafe, and I felt I needed to know what was happening. And you couldn't listen to a news show without them mentioning 9/11 for quite some time.
Yes.
And then at some point, it was too triggering for me, and it was impeding my healing, and I said, I have to shut this off.
You know, I cannot imagine just the pain and of not knowing where Michael was. I mean, for those first couple of days, yeah, hoping he had survived, but mm-hmm, but hearing nothing from him.
Yeah, I too rushed home from work to put the TV on.
Yeah,
just in time to see the first tower collapse.
And that was the North Tower, right?
That was the South Tower.
The South Tower.
And one of the things I think that's so pertinent is that many people tuned in and saw that. And it wasn't just a photo. People experienced it, even though it was through television. But I think that they experienced that and the devastation from that. So,
I mean, what was that like for you?
Yeah,
I cannot.
Well, I panicked because I didn't know. They identified the tower in a different way, and so I wasn't sure which one Michael was in, and then I kept watching to see the second tower collapse, and that's, I think I went into shock for a little bit.
Yeah,
I remember just like walking around my house, crying and shaking, and you know, just it's still so unbelievable.
It really is. It really is. I remember going up. Our son was in college in New York at the time, and you know, so that there's that whole story. But it's, you know, nothing like what you went through, obviously, Tara. But we were together this past weekend, and what did we do? We relived that day. Like, well, you called me, and then I called you, and yeah, I didn't know where you were, and you didn't. I mean, it was like sitting Shiva in so many ways, but we had to tell this narrative. We had to tell this story.
Yeah. A couple of a while ago,
Mrs.
I was
Tara,
with someone.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was with a group of women doing a walking thing, and this is about 4 years ago, and they did not know I lost my husband. One person did, and they started talking about 9/11 and what it was like for them that morning and picking up their children, and all they went through it. And as hard as it was for me to hear and not share, I thought they need to go through this. This is their identity too. It's not just my loss again. So they needed to process it and connect with each other around this event that happened.
So, I mean, I think with traumatic events, we do want to tell that story, right? In our, perhaps in our own way and with our own words.
It's not only that we want to tell our story, we need to tell our story. Mm-hmm. The more we tell our story, the more we work it out. The more we are able to, you know, I mean, it's like whenever something really horrible happens to you and you can't talk about it, and then when you first talk about it, there's such a release, right? That's what this is about. Mm-hmm. This is about a yearly, scheduled, repetitive release of tensions around this particular event and what it did to us as a country, what it did to individuals, what it did to institutions, right? And I think it's really important to kind of recognize that this is therapy, right?
This is what
it's
we're
absolutely therapeutic. Yes.
And you're an art therapist.
Yes.
And you're nodding, Tara.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the talking needs to happen, and people need they need to connect to it, and they need to help integrate it into their brain. And one of the benefits of art therapy is that that's what it does. It takes those fragmented traumatic memories and tries to make sense of them in the brain. And it usually works a little faster than talking. But most of us don't have access to art therapy, so we talk about it.
Says Tara Bain, the art therapist, our guest today on The Connection. And again, we've been talking about September 11th. Tragically, sadly, her husband died that day. He worked on the 100th floor of the North Tower. And again, she's written a memoir. It's called Evolution of a Heart, From the Darkness of 9/11 to Rebuilding a Life and Finding Joy. Barbie Zelizer is with us as well. She's the Raymond Williams Professor Emeritus at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. And I used to interview her on Radio Times, talking a lot about memory and images, especially in times of crisis. In fact, Barbie, I was actually listening to an old interview that I did with you about September 11th. And one of the things that you said, and I wrote it down, is I think I asked you, was, why do we need these memories? And you said, memories are the tools that we think with. And I found that really moving and quite profound.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, actually, it's not my quote. Okay. It is actually one of the very eminent scholars in collective memory. But the full quote is, memories are not things we think about, but tools we think with. And the idea is that when we are engaged in something like collective, I mean, it's a very different idea of memory from, say, psychology, right? We don't assume that the further you get from the memory, you know, the less accurate it's going to be. Collective memories are not about accuracy. They are about being able to reconfigure the past for some kind of present-day aim, whether it's, I don't know, cohesion or community building or norm clarification. We pull from the past so that we can understand the present a little bit better.
Yeah. And I wonder, Tara, too, about how you block out, or if you block out, all the sort of noise around this event, especially it seems like this year. I feel like there's just a lot of accusation and politics and things that have nothing to do with you and other people who lost someone that day. How do you deal with that?
It's upsetting, and I often feel lately like did we learn our lesson as a nation, and are we any safer? And just the idea of distracting from what we should be thinking about for that day instead of all those other things and the arguments that bubble up and the political strife that happens. It is upsetting.
I can imagine.
After 9/11, everyone came together, and it was a good feeling. And it helped me to feel safe. I'm sure it helped many people to feel safe after such a horrific event. And this is very unsettling now.
Yeah. How about for you, Barbie? How do you see it?
I would agree very much. I think it's super unsettling. I think that we are in the midst of a divided public, a divided community, a divided collective. And so, but yet we all share this memory, right? And that's the hard part, right? Like, if you believe something politically or religiously or you know, whatever modicum, right, you're kind of following, you have as much right to it as I do, right? And again, this is you know, moving beyond folks who actually lost loved ones.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is the part of the collective. And so the question really is, where will this go? And that's why I think it's important to remember that the real memory work is really only starting now.
Yeah.
It's, you know, everything that has been kind of bubbling up, and you can look at the different anniversaries and you can see them, you know, this is a year of divisiveness. This is a year of kind of more unity. It's all preparatory, right, to the work that needs to happen now.
Wow.
Do you think that some of this, what's happening now, is a way for a person personally to distract from their own emotion about what September 11th means to them?
That's a really good question.
I wonder.
I mean, I'm sure it's the case. I'm sure it's also the case that people, you know, strategically don't want to be focused on 9/11 because they want to be focused on something that's more germane to their interests, right? I mean, that's a less generous way of saying what you just said. But I think that But that's always the case, right? Mm-hmm. We're always kind of, you know, going back and forth between, you know, competing interests about who really has who can play the role of kind of guiding the memory into the next moment.
Yeah. Terry, you described going to ground zero.
Yes.
And that having almost like a revelation there. I remember going as well, and first of all, how quiet New York City was.
Oh, my
it was
goodness.
Just eerily quiet, and you grew up, you know, in the city, so you know what that city sounds like. But why did you feel like you needed to go to the site?
At the time, the first time I went, I still believed and hoped and wished that Michael would come home. Mm-hmm. And it was a week and a half later, and I know everyone around me realized he was not. He did not survive, but I still wanted to see him come through my door.
Right.
And I'm a curious person. I also have to see things. Like, that's just who I am. And so when I had the opportunity, I said, yes, let's go. And that, it was a shock to me to see those buildings. They were a mountain of rubble. That's how I describe it. And and it was a war zone. There were armed military people around, and we couldn't even get that close because it was such devastation. But when I saw with my eyes, I mean, I saw it on TV, but I still, when I was actually down there, that's when I said, oh my gosh, he didn't survive.
Right.
Michael's dead. And right. I was with my sister, and that gave me another layer of grief, I guess. It really, like, now I still had the fear and the anxiety and the nervousness, and now I had to deal with the grief piece of it. Like,
it was
that's
real.
When it started.
It was real.
Yeah. The other week was his, you know, all the magical thinking. He's going to come home. Hospital's going to call me that he's there. They rescued him. He's missing somewhere. You know, all that. You know, I just wanted him home.
Sure. I'll tell you what, another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Tara Bain. She's written a memoir. It's called Evolution of a Heart, From the Darkness of 9/11 to Rebuilding a Life and Finding Joy. And she was talking about the fact that she lost her husband, Michael, on that day, September 11th. He worked in the North Tower. Barbie Zelizer with us as well, and she's a professor emeritus at the Annenberg School for Communication at Penn. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We are reflecting on the impact of September 11th, 25 years later, what we've learned about trauma and grief and healing and memory. And again, Tara Bain and Barbie Zelizer are our guests. Tara, you're an art therapist, and you have worked with people dealing with their own particular traumas.
Yes. Yeah.
Did that help you with your trauma?
Interesting enough, it didn't at first. I was encouraged to take out my paints and start painting, and my painting scared me. Oh. It was very violent and upsetting, and I saw my rage in the painting as well. And I couldn't finish the painting. I put my paints down for quite a few years. But reflecting back on it, I needed to express it in that way because that's what I was experiencing. And that's what I did with my clients, but I never had such a horrific experience to be translating it into art until then.
Yeah. But now you can talk about it and reflect on it, but I would think rage would be such a natural, if I can use that, response to what happened to you and to Michael.
I really tried hard not to go there. I didn't want the terrorists to take that from me. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't going to help me.
Yeah.
I mean, anger and rage can motivate you to do something, but there was nothing I could do. And so I just, you know, it's still there. I still get angry. I mean, they just came up with the finally a hearing date for the Guantanamo Bay.
But not till 2028.
Not till 2028. So I still have anger, but I I'm sure it comes out in different ways in my art now, but it's much more manageable.
Yeah.
It's safe now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Barbie, there, I guess with these traumatic kind of events, and especially when there's all this mistrust of government, then what fills in the holes is disinformation and misinformation and conspiracy theories and lies. And I wonder how you see, you know, as people are trying to make sense and relive and trying to connect with people that might have gone through it, how that can make it so much tougher.
Yeah, it's really an interesting question, Marty, because I wouldn't have connected it necessarily to 9/11, but I think you're right. Look, I think that what this experience and its memory does is it kind of soaks in whatever is in the atmosphere. And so, yes, of course, there's misinformation and disinformation, you know, including claims that of who's being carried out by a firefighter, right? But I think that the equally important question is to chart where we've come as a society and how is that kind of inputting to the memory. And you mentioned distrust in government. I mean, there was immediately after 9/11, there was a short, you know, rise there. You know, people were really trusting in what the government was doing. And then all across the 2000s dipped precipitously. Yeah. And of course, we never got back. And so here we are in a moment where distrust is all over the place. And lo and behold, what is the new feature for thinking about 9/11 is health and health effects. And the fact that the government is seen now to have lied to people about the toxic air around Ground Zero. Yeah. So I'm not saying that that's not correct, but what I'm saying is it fits the larger environment and it fits what's happening to us more generally as a collective. And that's exactly how it grows.
Yeah. Tara, I wondered too, we mentioned this earlier, but other widows or perhaps widowers that have had to deal with the kinds of things that you had to deal with, the kind of loss. Do you feel like a kinship with them?
Yes.
Do you feel like you're part of the same team in a way?
Yeah. As I said, when I first got together with the other family members, it was, dare I say, like refreshing because they knew. And we created a really tight bond for many years. And then as time went on, you know, different people took different paths and moved on in different ways. But I stayed very close with Grace Godshalk until she died, and I gave her eulogy. I still have a few friends that I touch base with a couple of times a year. But we don't see each other every... I mean, we were in support group for a couple of years, so we got close.
Yeah. Is it, I mean, I think we often have the feeling that when you go through a trauma that you're forever changed, but you're always kind of a damaged person. But I think we're learning more post-September 11th that people are resilient and they can heal and you can heal and feel grief and pain and loss. You're nodding your head. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think that the message that I got a lot was move on. Find someone else to marry, all of those messages. And that's like a societal thing. Like, I think I experienced people were uncomfortable and still are with grief. And
your grief.
My grief, for sure, yes. And I think part of the reason for the book was because I want people to know who are experiencing grief that your grief is your grief and it's there and don't expect that it's going to go away. But it doesn't take over your life, and you can find a way to incorporate it in a healthy way. And yes, we are resilient, and we can make it through these things. And that doesn't mean we have to shut the doors on that grief.
You talk about making choices. I mean, we all hopefully have choices in our life, but making choices for yourself?
Yeah, making choices to participate in things, to be a part of different groups that were helping with my healing, making choices with my career at some point that it was now I needed to be on my own and do my own thing. And it's just an evolution. Like we change and we can still honor the ones that we love and go on and, you know, have a fulfilled life, and I feel I do. But that doesn't take away Michael and what I had and what I grieve that we didn't get.
Right, right. I mean, it is having all these competing emotions at the same time,
yeah.
But being able to live with them.
Yeah. I mean, I think when we shun our grief or put it aside, it grows. It's like anger. If we don't address our anger, it can grow and grow and grow. There's space for it both.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's
Barbie, I was thinking of memorials and cemeteries and battlefields and museums. I mean, that, you know, us human beings, we go there. I mean, I remember going to Auschwitz, and I had to be there because I wanted, like you were talking about, Tara, sometimes you just want to see something for yourself. Why is that important, do you think, to us human beings?
Well, it's important actually for a historical reason, because it used to be, I mean, in the days of yore, there was more naturally occurring memory. There was tradition. People regularly oriented to the past. People were reminded of the past through oral culture, right? And I think that the assumption, it's not just me thinking, the assumption is that as there has been less naturally occurring memory, what we need is battlefields, cemeteries. We need a place to go to. We need a place to recognize. We need a place that we know that when we walk inside of this structure, that the main impulse, right, is to remember. And so it's a gift to us. They are all a gift to us. And I think that the more we can recognize the role that they continue to play, the healthier we become as a collective. And I very much agree with you when you're saying, you know, if you don't give these things an outlet, they just grow inside you and rot.
Yeah, 100%.
And Sarah, there's a garden of in Bucks County that you have a bench there.
Yes. Yeah, at the Garden of Reflection, and it was important that I was a part of that for many reasons, and one was to give back to the community, but also to have a space where people can go and reflect and remember what happened in a peaceful way, not aggressively, and that life continues there. So that's really important. And then there is a bench in Michael's honor. So
yeah, under a tree, isn't
under
it?
Under a tree. That's a tree we had in our yard. So the same tree. And I go for myself for sure to remember Michael and you know, when I miss him, I'll go and just. I don't have a cemetery. They never just recovered his body. And so for me, those rituals are important for us, I feel, as a society. We have rituals all over, and this is a space that I can have my ritual.
Yeah. And people leave, there's a place for people to leave notes?
There will be for year.
Okay.
Yeah. And we did that, I believe, at the 10th anniversary mm-hmm. as well. And they can leave their messages on boards.
You described going to Guantanamo Bay to watch the, I guess it was a hearing or
pre-trial
hearing for was it for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? Or
it was for all five.
For all five.
Yeah. They're still in pre-trial. It's been years. It was very intense. And people also, it was many years later even, it was 2016, I believe, that I went the first time, and they were saying, well, why do you want to go? And for me, it was, this is monumental. This is a way I honor Michael,
right.
But it's also a way that this is still part of the story and it's unwritten. So it's important to, if I have an opportunity to be involved in something like that, I want to take that opportunity.
And you even talked to some of the defense attorneys.
Yes.
As you write. What did you want to tell them, or what did you want to hear?
I don't know what I wanted to hear. I think I wanted to hear, why would you defend these people? I didn't get a good answer. I mean, I can respect a few of them really are involved in it because they're just against the death penalty, and I can respect that. And so... it didn't help me, but I guess it gave me a better perspective on their motivation.
Did you want to see them? I mean, did you want to look at them?
The terrorists?
Yeah.
Yes.
You wanted to see what they
looked like? I'm the curious one. I needed to see them. I was in a room with glass panel walls, so I wasn't in the room with them.
Right.
But it did, my heart skipped a beat. I was sort of a rush of anger and fear all mixed up when I saw them.
Yeah, it must have been terrifying mm-hmm. in so
yes.
many ways.
Yeah.
I wonder too, Barbie, and this is picking up on, you said that we're still processing this, and then maybe we're just at the beginnings of make, do we make sense of this? Is that what we're trying to do?
I mean, do we make sense of any event?
No, I don't think we do.
I mean,
so what
I think,
are we trying to do?
Well, I think the question really is how much repetition do we need around 9/11 before we settle into a story that makes the most sense to the most people? It will never work for everyone.
No.
But it will work for some. And I think that, you know, I think it's a positive thing that we take as long as we do, because you can't decide that something is iconic a year after the event. You can't decide something that this will never change history if history hasn't gone ahead, right? So, you know, I think it's a conservative response to memory formation. But we are a large people, and there's a lot of things that feed into us as a population. So I think it is the right way to go.
Does nostalgia come into play with this?
You know, I've thought a lot about nostalgia, and I have a real problem with it. There's no question that nostalgia is, you know, even if it's the nostalgia of what was before, right? But I think that nostalgia doesn't exactly help us see clearly. And I think that what we need, especially now, I mean, we look at the trial, we look at the delay, we look at the delay in opening documents. I mean, we don't need to be in a nostalgic mode.
Right. That's the rose-colored glasses.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's not what we're dealing with here. Yeah. Terry, you have a son.
Yes.
Who's 17.
Yes.
Have you talked to him? Michael's not his dad, I should say, but have you talked? How do you talk to him about Michael?
Yeah.
And what happened?
He grew up with it. He grew up going to the garden. He was, I think, 4 when we went to the museum in Manhattan. He came. And he's removed from it for sure. But I guess out of his generation, he knows a lot more than others, but he's still 17 and still, you know, I was just talking to Barbie before and saying, I just got a text from him saying, on Friday afternoon, can I go get my hair cut? And I said, no, we can't do that.
Right.
So,
right.
You know,
he's a teenager.
He's a teenager. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I want him to know about Michael, and I talk about Michael, and I want him to be aware of what happened. I think it's really important. But I also don't want to burden him with my grief, although, you know, I'm sure it's there for him because it's there. but yeah, and he's a great kid. So I'm grateful that I have him, and I'm grateful I have my partner. And, you know, there together, we will get through it.
We're almost out of time here, but was it healing in 10 seconds or less to write this book?
Yes.
Healing for you?
Yes, it was.
To put it all down
on
paper?
To put the words, yeah. I mean, I do more of the art, and so writing it was really cathartic.
Well, Tara Bain, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection, for the book, and for your willingness to share, obviously, really difficult time in your life, and I think you've given us a lot to think about and care about. So thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And again, the book is called Evolution of a Heart, From the Darkness of 9/11 to Rebuilding a Life and Finding Joy. And I should add that she is an art therapist. And Barbie Zelizer, as always, thank you for joining us today on the show as well. She is the Raymond Williams Professor Emeritus at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Debbie Builder produces The Connection. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.